You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
We have peace now in the Middle East, first time that anyone can remember that ever happening.
Trump and the Republicans need to get off their butt and start negotiating with the Democrats.
This must be the COP that keeps 1.5 degrees Celsius within reach.
Your job here is not to fight one another. Your job here is to fight this climate crisis together.
Welcome to World News Weekly. I'm Nick Ludlam, SBS World News' international editor, standing in for Claudia, who will be checking in on me shortly, I hope, from the Philippines, where she's covering the aftermath of yet another massive storm. And keeping me on the straight and narrow here in Sydney is Peggy Giacomelos, legend of SBS Radio. Thanks, Peggy.
Thanks, Nick, for that introduction, and thanks to all our listeners. This is episode 36 of the podcast.
This week on the pod, we'll get the latest on the COP30 in Brazil and why it's being called the make-or-break climate summit. Plus, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is coming under fire, both on the front line and from accusations of corruption.
And we'll also delve into the murky world of cyber warfare, with chatbots increasingly being used as weapons of disinformation. Lara Schwetz from SBS Audio will be joining us a little bit later, and also stick around for some artistic relief. Apparently, it'll be a blast from the past.
Yep, stay tuned for that one. But let's go first to the Philippines.
This is the road to northern Luzon. Farms and families' livelihoods vanishing under floodwaters spanning kilometres. As we get further north, Fung Wong's trail of destruction lines the coast. Seaside homes and huts toppled not by the typhoon, but by the sheer force of the storm surge it created.
International correspondent and the pod's very own Claudia Farhart joins us now from Aurora Province in the central Luzon region of the Philippines. It's where the latest typhoon made landfall, but the epic size of the storm has wrought destruction across two-thirds of the vast archipelago. Claudia, thanks for freeing up some time for us.
Anything for the pod, guys. Hello, Nick. Hello, Peggy.
G'day, Claudia. Now, Claudia, can you describe the level of devastation you're seeing for us?
Yeah, it's fairly widespread, Peggy. So we made the drive from Manila up to Aurora Province this morning. And basically, as soon as you leave the capital, you start looking out and thinking you're on a bridge because there's just flooding everywhere. It's not a river. It's not a lake. It's not any body of water. It's just farms that are completely now gone. They're under what looked like kilometres and kilometres of water. Then as you get further into the north here into Aurora Province, the devastation's just really widespread. They've kind of, at this point, it's still only a couple of days in, so they've managed to sort of clear some of the trees and vegetation that have fallen, but all they've been able to do is really push them to the side of the road. So you're now just basically seeing banana trees, all sorts of fruit trees that they farm up here, just lining the sides of the roads, and then people's houses. A lot of the homes here are huts built by the sea, and they've just completely fallen to the side in a lot of cases, not from the typhoon, locals tell us, but from how strong the storm surge was. In some cases, it even washed some homes completely into the water. There's just nothing left of them, no rubble or anything. So the devastation's quite widespread.
Super Typhoon Fung Wong is the 21st major storm to hit the region this year alone. How are people coping there, and are they even coping?
Yeah, there's this real sense now that they're facing this massive cleanup, but they almost don't really know what the point is because this just keeps happening and keeps happening. The death toll this week compared to last week's was a lot lower because, you know, when it rose to more than 200 after Typhoon Kalmagi, I think it did scare a lot of people. So they took that early precaution to get out in time. But the destruction is no less severe. I mean, this was actually the stronger of the two storms. As you said, it covered something like two-thirds of the country. So there's just this sense of exhaustion. It's the sixth natural disaster in 6 weeks. It's hit areas that were already hit, that were still trying to recover. I think people just don't really know where to go from here, but they're kind of just taking it day by day because a lot of them are still in evacuation centres. They're not able to return home. They're really just trying to make it through every day.
Claudia, climate experts are saying warming seas are making storms even more powerful. What does the future look like for this region?
Yeah, climate scientists are saying the evidence is all pointing to one thing, that these storms are going to keep increasing in severity. And that's because when you have warmer water, as we know we now have, that only encourages these systems to build. You need warm water for these systems to develop, these typhoons. And also when you have a warmer atmosphere, as we also know we have, it just allows the systems to hold more moisture and therefore dump more rain. So what does it mean for the future in the Philippines? It just means these storms are going to keep happening and probably are going to keep happening more severe each time. We're hearing from locals here that, yeah, we're used to typhoons. We prepare for them all the time. I mean, the Philippines has something like 20 a year, but we're not used to them in this intensity. So I think at the moment, yeah, people are trying to make it through day by day. But if you look at the government response to this, they've now declared a one-year state of calamity to deal with the recovery effort from these, not just from Fung Wong or from Kalmagi, but from the cumulative effect of all of these disasters the Philippines has had over the past few weeks. There's going to be a massive cleanup and recovery effort ahead, but I think a lot of people are asking the question, what is the point if these storms and these extreme weather events are just going to keep coming and keep coming in higher intensity?
Thanks for joining us, Claudia.
Okay, you two behave yourselves while Kat and I are away.
Never.
The United States of America is dumb as we want to be on this topic, but the state of California is not. And so we are going to assert ourselves, we're going to lean in, and we are going to compete in this space.
The climate summit in Brazil is being called Make or Break, as it's the last emissions targets moment when global leaders either do what's necessary or we will fly past 1.5 and even 2 degrees of warming. They've tried to play down the significance of all three leaders of the biggest emitters skipping the summit ahead of negotiations. And fairly reasonably for India and China, whose leaders have already set out their stalls. But Donald Trump isn't just missing in person. He is massively anti the entire premise of needing to save the planet and is doing his best to unravel every climate law and project he can. The US hasn't even sent a delegation to the Amazon in their absence. California's governor, Gavin Newsom, has shown up and called out Trump's climate stance as, quote, dumb. He's trying to style himself as the next president of the US, but to be fair, his state, the fourth biggest economy in the world, is pressing ahead with climate projects. Sadly, climate has become a political football in the US, one which Trump seems determined to kick into touch.
And the EU's been trying to present itself as the grown-up in the room, but they really struggled to even agree to their new targets. An 11th-hour compromise saw the tough commitments watered down by the Orbans and other right-wing climate sceptics of the bloc. The player that has quietly assumed that mantle is China, having achieved many of their targets ahead of time. And a new report says China's CO2 emissions have been flat or falling for 18 months, so a glimmer of hope, the world's biggest emitter is past its peak, Nick.
Right now, it is extremely difficult for everyone in Ukraine, enduring power outages, Russian strikes, and losses. It is absolutely unacceptable that amid all this, there are also schemes in the energy sector. I believe that the Minister of Justice and the Minister of Energy cannot remain in office. This is, among other things, a matter of trust.
One of the pod's tragically evergreen stories, that was Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky under fire both on the front line and from accusations of corruption within his entourage. Ukraine says around 300 Russian soldiers have now entered the contested city of Pokrovsk. And we've seen Mad Max-style footage of them driving in on motorbikes and battered vehicles. It seems the situation there is getting more dire by the day. Battles also continue in Kupiansk, where both Kyiv and Moscow claim to have the upper hand. While Ukrainian military commanders warn the situation has become, quote, significantly worse in parts of the Zaporizhia region.
And also Zelensky had to reassure Ukrainians and the EU that he was fully on board with cracking down on corruption after allegations of a multi-million dollar kickback scheme were announced by the National Anti-Corruption Bureau, the very same bureau whose power Zelensky tried to curb earlier this year. After tens of thousands protested the move, he was forced to climb down.
What's probably galling people as well is that the revelations are linked to construction contracts for building defences for the state nuclear power company, Energoatom. At a time when many Ukrainians are staring down a barrel of a freezing winter due to Russia's relentless bombing of the energy infrastructure, and adding insult to injury, it's being reported in the Ukrainian media that a key person of interest is Zelensky's old buddy and business partner, who apparently skipped town shortly before his apartment was raided. He appears also to be one of seven people that have just been charged.
And ironically, as that bombshell was dropped, Zelensky was conducting a sit-down interview with a European broadcaster when the lights went out. That's hopefully not a sign of troubles to come.
Yeah, it's a real worry for Zelensky, I think. He's been on the defensive politically for some time now. Russia, of course, has been pushing the narrative from the start that he isn't legitimately running the country because they haven't held elections, which is absolutely legitimate given they are in the middle of a war with Russia. But it adds to mounting concerns he's been surrounding himself with trusted advisers and cutting out other people, both political and military, much to their anger, of course. Something he may have to reckon with if he can't get a handle on this pretty quickly. And that won't be easy. Corruption has always been a major problem in Ukraine, no less so with vast amounts of money from foreign aid swilling around the place.
From what's happening on the ground in Ukraine to what is increasingly becoming another form of warfare in countries around the world, the use of large language models like ChatGPT is becoming increasingly popular to push disinformation narratives online to gain both military and political advantage.
Now, some experts are warning that pro-Kremlin actors have been flooding the internet with fake news to influence these chatbots. To take us through this murky world of cyber manipulation is Lara Schwetz from SBS Audio, who's been following this story for some time now. Lara, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for joining us, Lara.
Thank you for having me.
What are some of the examples of online grooming or disinformation that you've come across?
Well, just earlier this year, several research organizations, think tanks, both in Europe and in the US, they have uncovered a whole network that is called Pravda Network. And it has been flooding internet with fake news. These are fake articles, and they've counted around 6 million of those. And 5 million of those are also repurposed in different languages. And so this network is basically flooding the internet, as I just said, and Wikipedia kind of picks up on those articles, and then later on, AI chatbots use Wikipedia as their source, but ultimately they use these fake narratives as their source when they generate answers to certain prompts of the users. And that's what NewsGuard from the US and CheckFirst from Finland have uncovered.
Now, chatbots and AI are infiltrating nearly every aspect of our lives. Lara, you just mentioned Wikipedia. What are some of the other ways this is being done?
Yeah, so experts are concerned as well that these days people really use AI chatbots basically every day on a daily basis for, you know, as their psychologists even to prepare for an exam or to sort of, find like the cheapest store in the area. And the problem is that the experts are saying that some people don't have enough literacy around the use of chatbots. They believe that this is the truth, that whatever the chatbot is saying to them, this is like the final truth, basically. But whereas actually chatbots are approximation tools. So they just give their answers based on like the closest approximate answer that a human being would give you if they were to answer your question. So that's why there are calls for better literacy, digital literacy, better understanding what actually chatbots are, and that hopefully would also help people to be critical of the answers that they receive when they use chatbots, especially when it comes to news and current affairs.
Just another point. You mentioned news and current affairs before. That's the space we all work in. In your research for reporting here, what kind of things were you seeing in terms of AI and its impact in this space?
I should take a step back here and actually say that this is this particular story about AI grooming, as we call it, not us, but like as it's called in this area. This is the second part of a two-part series about Russian propaganda and the way it spread in Australia and around the world. So the first part, we published it in September, and we were talking exactly about the kinds of disinformation that comes from the Kremlin. And that is mostly disinformation this past year, after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. This is mostly about Ukraine. So this is propaganda that seeks to undermine international support of Ukraine. It seeks to undermine the understanding of what the invasion is and to sort of shift the narrative and make the audience question, question maybe this invasion was actually substantiated or, you know, anything like that. And so if we're talking about particular kinds of stories that could be fakes about Zelensky's family being corrupt or Zelensky himself to, you know, crazy stories like biolabs in Ukraine producing nuclear mosquitoes or all kinds of weird myths and stories about that particular country. And with the rise of AI technologies as well, there have been examples of the use of AI to generate images and videos to kind of fake who said what and what politician said what. And there have been examples during the election in the U.S. or when certain videos were circulating on Twitter about Kamala Harris, things that she never said, things that she never did, but it appeared as though that was her. And with chatbots, I just said, this is more about the flooding of the internet. And so Check First and NewsGuard, they uncovered these links between Wikipedia articles and chatbot prompts, but actually that lead to the source, which is Pravda Network, which are the articles that are all basically fake. This is fake news, whatever you look in this 6 million articles pool.
This technology is still constantly evolving and is being taken up on a massive scale and will only get bigger, one would imagine. Are we even equipped to combat that?
Yeah, that's another important part of this conversation. So in Australia, we are one of the first countries in the world who actually have implemented safeguards around AI. But as one of the experts told us in our article and the package, is that these safeguards have not really been turned into any legal frameworks yet. And that is one. And the second one, there are, of course, discussions around censorship. So how do you actually implement safeguards around AI and misinformation without curbing freedom of speech? And so last year, there were discussions in the parliament here in Australia. The previous Albanese government, they put forward a bill that would allow ACMA, Australian Communications and Media Authority, it would allow it to have legal powers to take down certain content. But the bill didn't go through. So the EU, on the other hand, they do have certain legislation around AI and also digital safety. So they have the so-called Digital Services Act, and it actually puts the responsibility on the platforms to make sure that no harmful content is published. And the fines are quite heavy. They can be up to, as one of the experts told us, up to 6% of the global turnover of that company. And then last year, the EU enacted an AI Act that also requires companies, particularly in high-risk settings, to be more transparent about their algorithms and their products to mitigate certain risks.
I guess as well, if we do institute laws and the like, it's still a question of implementation and enforcement. So a long way to go, it seems. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us, Lara. That's Lara Schwetz from SBS Audio. And her reporting was produced in collaboration with Jennifer Scherer, SBS Audio, and as part of a research trip hosted by the German Federal Foreign Office in cooperation with the National Press Club of Australia.
Time for a quick trip around the world to take a look at some of the other stories making headlines this week. Donald Trump has met behind closed doors with Syrian President Ahmed al-Sharaa in what was a landmark yet muted occasion in the White House. the former al-Qaeda commander who until just a few days ago was sanctioned by Washington as a foreign terrorist and had a $10 million bounty on his head, has reportedly signed on to an international alliance against the Islamic State group.
He also played some basketball with US military officials, shooting some hoops, and was gifted a MAGA hat.
Lucky him.
He later appeared on Fox News, no less, where he was asked if he held regrets about the 9/11 attacks in 2001. Al-Sharaa responded that he was only 19 years old and didn't have any decision-making power at that time.
But he did add that he felt for all the people that had died during the war. So that was something, I guess. Constitutional changes have passed Pakistan's Senate, paving the way for the country's army chief to receive expanded powers. They're already incredibly powerful, and for the remit of the Supreme Court to be curbed. Under the reforms, Asim Munir would take command of all military forces, not just the army, and receive legal immunity for life. The bill, which is yet to pass the lower house, has been criticised by the opposition as undemocratic.
And Indonesia has officially named former President Suharto a national hero at a ceremony in Jakarta. Suharto, who died in 2008, was a general when he assumed power and launched a brutal purge of anyone considered communist sympathisers, with hundreds of thousands killed. He ruled Indonesia for more than three decades and was widely regarded as a dictator. The current president bestowing the honour was also a general under Suharto's rule and his former son-in-law. Human rights groups have denounced the move, having Suharto's photo next to a Labour activist and a Suharto critic that was killed during his rule, only adding to the outrage, Nick.
I'm sure.
On this canvas, you're the creator. Anything that you want, you can build here. This is your world. Your dreams come real here.
Now, Peggy, as you may have realised, this being your second turn on the pod, we do like to end with a test of news knowledge. So for 10 points, can you identify the owner of that soothing voice? And if so, why?
Absolutely, I can, Nick. And that's because I didn't instantly recognise him, but it crept up in me. It's the late Bob Ross demonstrating how to create one of his many masterpieces as part of his iconic show, The Joy of Painting. And probably the Gen X's upwards would remember Bob Ross.
Yeah, I do. Love Bob Ross. The TV host is back in the news this week, Peggy, after 30 of his some 30,000 original paintings were put up for auction. The first three went for more than $500,000 US combined. The money raised will go to help support public broadcasting in the US, which ran his shows for decades. After funding was cut under the Trump administration recently, Bob achieved cult status, of course, as you, I'm sure, will know, a legend of daytime television. A bit like you, Peggy. It wasn't just the voice, of course, the permed afro, the beard, the double denim. What an era. He died just over 30 years ago, but saw a revival in popularity during COVID and is still remembered with a lot of love and nostalgia.
Look, and yes, I was one of those to rediscover Bob Ross during COVID, following some of his tutorials, being stuck in one of the lockdown areas of Sydney. And I almost gifted some of those paintings to friends and relatives, but I decided in the end not to.
Lucky friends and relatives. Well, it's a shame we can't show them to our audience, unfortunately, but we will at some point try and do so. And that is some of the world this week. If you're enjoying the pod, be sure to like and subscribe. We'll have new episodes every Thursday. Thanks to our producers, yours truly, Ali Cheevers, Billy Dahlenberg, and of course, a huge thank you to you, Peggy.
Thanks for having me. And remember to check out all our other podcasts at SBS News. They include SBS News In Depth, and you can get those wherever you get this podcast. See you next time.
Cheers.